transformation. So I kind of, I create God and I say, okay, stop the time, now shift the time and then let the system go on, okay? The transformation of the system really falls into here. Now, yeah, how do I think about this now? So now assume you find observables that do not change. So this is just a transformation. But now assume the transformation is a symmetry. It's like if I say, think of an object that's symmetric under mirroring, I don't need to give you the heart shape. You could think this, you could think this, and so on, okay? Assume this observable process is symmetric under this, then it shouldn't change anything, so that should be f of t. Okay? It would be a time translation symmetry. And of course, it will not be true for any system, it will not be true for any observable, like this is, this mirror symmetry is not true for any shape. But for the systems and observables where it's true, this may hold. But what does that mean? Well, that means nothing else, that for all t, f doesn't change in time, doesn't it? Well, f keep your space as f of t, and that's true for all t, then f, the derivative of f with respect to t is zero. F doesn't change. Doesn't that mean the same thing? Okay. So we found time translation symmetry, and we now know why we call it a symmetry, can just be written like this. Questions? Okay. There to ask questions. Very simple ones to very complicated ones. Yeah?
What does the A represent there?
The A is just the real number, so I should have said that. It's the amount by which I let time shift. I say, let's introduce summer time, A equals 1 hour. Okay? I shift time.
And how does that time shift?
No, you shouldn't think of it physically. It's a theoretical thing. I say, look, for example, my height, okay, is probably today, it's probably a constant, okay? And that means that my height is an observable, so it's the Q3 observable of the center of my brain, maybe, and it actually is independent of time. So if you look at Frederick's height, that's why it's Frederick's height today plus 1 day is Frederick's height today. But this is true, yeah, and we assume we take an observable that satisfies that. So like I could say, take a shape that is mirror symmetric on this axis, any such shape, which is not like this, it's not the height of a baby, because that will change in time. Okay, so it's not this, but this is symmetric. And so this is also symmetric in time, and a time translation.
So you're translating time with symmetrical at the same?
Since this observable f, I assume to be independent of time, f of t plus a is f of t. And there's nothing to be understood, it's more like a postulate. Let's consider an f that has this property. Okay? Yeah?
What does the equal sign of the two dots for?
That means it's defined as. So usually I write three lines.
Is that the same thing?
They're the same thing. This one makes it a bit more non-symmetrical, which is good because this side is defined in terms of this side. And the three lines are less symmetric, and therefore I actually prefer this sign, but sometimes I write the three lines. Okay. So we see we have an observable that's time translation invariant that actually means df by dt is zero. Okay? Good. So time translation invariant. Okay. Time translation symmetry. Who can rewrite the last equation in terms of Poisson brackets? Or tell me how to do that.
F from I equals 0.
F comma h equals 0 because we showed before that f comma h is the f value t. If the f value t is 0, f comma h is 0. Okay, looks simple. So this means nothing else but the f value t is 0. It means nothing else but f is time translation invariant. Means nothing else but f is conserved. Like energy is conserved. Ah, energy. Energy is conserved in Poisson brackets. Someone else?
H comma H equals zero.
H comma H is zero. Could it be any different? What is if I take any f?
That is what?
Why is that zero for any f?
Well, because of anti-symmetry.
Yes.
If you switch.
Well, anti-symmetry is f comma g is minus g comma f. If I replace the g by f, you get f comma f is minus f comma f, means 2 f comma f equals 0 divided by 2 f comma f is 0. It's an immediate consequence of our construction of the bracket. And it has nothing to do with the h itself. That means, even if I wanted to, I couldn't find an h that is not conserved in time. Because you see, h comma h is 0 by construction of the bracket, but that also means that h is conserved in time. That means energy is conserved in time. And so you see, the construction of the bracket has in it, structurally, our basic assumption that we have a conservative system. Namely, one in which energy is conserved. And because I wanted to define this anti-symmetric bracket, I restricted myself in the beginning to conservative systems. Okay? If you don't get conservative systems, you can't construct the bracket like this. I think there's a possibility, I don't really know, but I think there is one to construct even for non-conservative systems, but that's clearly beyond the scope of this measure. Okay, anyway, that was just an aside. So the observable is conserved in time means f comma h is 0. It's that simple. It was conserved in time. Let's start at the other end. Let's assume an observable has a vanishing bracket with the I component of the momentum. So the energy has a very big role in this time generation. And now assume this is 0. F, any observable bracket would be 0. What does that mean? What does that mean? Well, we find out by calculating the bracket. J equals 1, 2, 3, df by dqj, dpi by dpj, minus df by dpj, dpi by dqj. What's dpi by dpj?
Delta.
Delta, I think. Right. What's dpi by dqj?
Zero.
Term goes. The sum of all j, but only if I equals j, so the whole thing equals df by dqi. Aha! So f with pi is zero doesn't mean df by t is zero, it means df by dqi is zero. But what is that in terms of our symmetry language? No, in terms of the symmetry, not the f by dq means f is translation, time translation invariant, and the f by dqi equals 0 means f is invariant under what?
Position
translation. Now, f is space translation invariant or symmetric, but only in the I direction, in the I direction. But if you're required to be true for I equals 1, 2, and 3, then f is completely invariant in whatever direction you go in space. Okay? I mean, it's not true for any observable in any system, but there could be observables where it is true. Okay? So these are the two things. Okay, so that's still simple enough, but the showdown is approaching. So this is just reformulating symmetric ideas about how observable could not change in time conserved, and how an observable could not change in space. And these are two different conditions. Right? I mean, there might be some observables that do not change in space, but they change in time, or the other way around. There could be some that do the same. The really interesting bit comes if I make this statement, assume not any observable is time conserved, but the momenta themselves. That means ith component of the momentum is conserved in time. It's obvious, huh? From equation A. So this statement can be read in two ways. Again, this is not true in general, but we just assume we have a system such that this is true. Okay, so assume we have a system such that this is true. So let's read it in two ways. A suggests this means Pi, the ith component of the momentum, is conserved in time. Momentum conserved. What is momentum conserved? Okay? Does everyone understand that this equation means that momentum is conserved? Okay? Questions? Okay. But the very same equation, I can use anti-symmetry if you want. I can take it around like this. I have a minus, but it's obviously the same equation because I can get rid of the minus. Okay? The very same equation is of this form, but now f is h. You see that? So that means h is translation invariant. So the second way you can look at this statement is that h is space translation invariant. So we have these two statements, that f, h equals 0 for any f means f is time conserved, and f, p equals 0 for any f means f is translational invariant. Now we assume we have a system with p, h, and now we want to interpret what this statement means. And for the evaluation of the first statement, I say f is pi. And I use this, and I see all that means that the momentum is time conserved. But I can also say this is the free variable observable f. Then I use the second statement, and I see the very same statement means that h, the energy, is time, is space translation invariant. So one and the same statement can be read in two different ways. But you see, it is the same statement. It means if I say momentum is conserved, and I express it in Poisson-Bragg formulation, I said at the same time that h is space translation invariant. If I had given you a homework, say, write in Poisson brackets fact A, you would have written that. Write in Poisson brackets fact B, you would have written exactly the same thing. That means they are the same. They are equivalent. And that's a special incarnation of Newton's theorem. And remember, h describes the whole system. So then the theorem in this incarnation means momentum is conserved if and only the classical mechanical system is invariant under translation. By the way, Noether is Ebbie Noether, obviously a woman. Okay, H is space translation invariant. So this is kind of the democracy of classical mechanics. Okay, so in school you're taught to repeat in the beginning, there is an energy conservation law, there is a momentum conservation law. and that is not true. There is a momentum conservation law if and only if your system is translation invariant. If it doesn't matter whether I do the experiment here or over there. Okay? If that is not given, there is no momentum conservation. And you see, this is a deep insight that links the symmetries of the system to the conservation laws in the system. Now, if you learn in school there is a momentum conservation law, what about the following counter example? The surface of the Earth, we have a stone. You let it go. It falls. It gets faster and faster and faster until it hits the ground. Well, it gets faster and faster means it picks up momentum. What about the momentum conservation law? Because the momentum is not conserved. It gets bigger and bigger and bigger while it falls, okay? What's with the momentum conservation law? Well, there is none. And Newton's theorem tells you that. He says, if the classical mechanical system is invariant under translations, well, in that direction, then we know that if I go from here down to here, H changes, because H has this component, it has a kinetic energy plus potential energy. And if you go down here, even if you hold some, down here, the potential energy is different. So in a sense, the presence of this gravitational field breaks the translational symmetry in z direction. But in x and y direction, you know that if you calculate this parabola that the stone flies, okay, you know that in those directions the momentum is conserved. That's uniform motion. But in z direction, the momentum picks up. That is because the gravitational field is such that it's here the same as over here, or over here if I'm at the same height. But it changes if I go up. So you see, that's in violation of Newton's theorem of the condition for momentum conservation. Momentum is conserved in those directions in which H does not change in space. There it's called momentum conservation, otherwise it's broken. So that's a qualitative insight. So as I write in the script, there's a smart-ass answer to the question, why do stones fall down when I drop them in an Earth gravitational field? And well, the answer is, well, because of broken symmetry in the Z direction. Okay. And why does the momentum not change in that direction? Well, because there is symmetry. Okay. And that's this. And we already saw that the energy conservation law is this, that means energy is conserved whenever the energy is translation invariant in time. So that's almost trivial. But you see, space translation invariance corresponds to momentum conservation. Time translation invariance corresponds to energy conservation. In fact, the invariance of any observable F under H can be read in two ways. It can be read, F is time conserved. That's what we had before. But it can also be read, H is F-conserved. What do you mean by F-conserved? Well, it turns out that any observable generates a transformation. You see, H generates a transformation in time, that thing over there. This can be rewritten to make more explicit that the P's, the momenta, generate transformations in space. But any observable generates some type of transformation. For example, the angular momentum observables generate rotations. So if I say I have a system where H, the Poisson bracket of the Hamiltonian, with the I component of the angular momentum is zero, then I know that there are two things. First of all, the I component of the angular momentum is conserved in time. But I also know that the system has a rotation invariance around the I-axis. Okay, and so that for really every single observable, there is a generated transformation law. And what we will do next time, for those of you who want to choose the essential optional course, what we will do next time is to show how you use this insight, how you push that a bit further. And then we have all the machinery together in classical mechanics to write up quantum mechanics. So you might say, okay, this is so absurd, why are we doing this? The point is we almost have the machinery ready to write down classical mechanics in a form that we can immediately write down quantum mechanics. Okay? So that was the hidden agenda I didn't tell you, because these things are interesting all in their own right, and they have actually been discovered in their own right. But the big, big discovery, construction principle of quantum mechanics, at least by Dirac and others, was to use these structural analogies. So in particular, the classical observables in classical mechanics build a vector space equipped with a Poisson bracket. But the Poisson bracket, if I take any bracket that has these properties A and B up there, this is also called the Lie bracket, and the whole thing is called the Lie algebra. So the whole set of classical observables, meaning the whole set of all answers that I could have possibly give to all possible questions about a classical mechanical system, can be equipped with a bracket and takes the structure of a Lie algebra. Okay? That's just a word right now. But the exciting thing is, the same is true in quantum mechanics. It's just that the bracket is given by a different thing, by a different definition, but it has the same properties. And also the quantum observables are far from being functions of Q's and P's, but they also constitute the Lie algebra. Okay? And actually what you can do in classical mechanics, you can calculate what is Qi with Pj, and you will find out it's delta Pj. Calculate. It's very simple. Qi with Pj is delta Pj. And in quantum mechanics, one of the most basic equations, where now P and Q are different mathematical objects, and the bracket is a different bracket, that's why I write it like this. This thing, I, it's complex I, delta Ij, H bar, is the so-called commutation relation for Q's and P's, but I will explain to you why this is nothing but the Heisenberg uncertainty relation. So you see, the Heisenberg uncertainty relation structurally already appears in classical mechanics. But because the objects are all interpreted differently, it doesn't manifest itself physically. Okay? I'll explain that in detail. This is the outlook. Okay? But all these structures directly go to quantum mechanics. Yeah? Or how does a system evolve in time? Well, in classical mechanics, the f by dt equals f, h with the Poisson bracket. In quantum mechanics, the f by dt equals the bracket of f, h. Different objects f and h, same bracket. And so on. And we'll push the whole thing a bit further, and you will be exposed, at least in classical mechanics, to almost the full formalism of quantum mechanics, and in the end, and that's the beauty of the thing. But now you can start appreciating why Goethe's theorem that was just formulated in terms of these brackets, why that, of course, will also hold in quantum mechanics, because it's the same structure. It's represented in a different way, like vector spaces come from Hamming function spaces, arrow spaces, and so on. Representation is different, but actually the structure is the same. And therefore, in quantum mechanics, it's still true. If you have a system that's rotation invariant, like an atom, then the angular momentum is conserved. And that's something you use when you calculate the hydrogen atom. Okay? And one last sentence is, keep in mind that all these insights, and this wasn't outlook, but all these insights are short today. We started with Newton's equation, and we didn't put anything else in. Everything I said is a statement about Newton's equation. And that's kind of the beauty of it, that you can push it so far and get so deep insights from this harmless F equals MA. Okay? And that, I think, makes very much the spirit of our subject. If we look at equations, we massage them, we look at them from different points of view. Of course, there's a lot of creativity in there by people like Hamilton and all these guys, okay, and Poisson. In order to come up with that. Yeah. But at the end of the day, it's just a very clever way to rewrite what the kind of new control is. Okay, thanks.
Okay, I'm just going to get set up and maybe give me breathing space for a minute. And what we'll do is just look at... So how many of you know how to modify matrices together? Have you done that? Do you know that? No, some do, some don't. So, okay, so we'll just go through it quickly in about 5 minutes. And then we'll get on to some physics from one of the guests. Around, so hopefully we have enough for everyone. So they reach to the back. Actually, if we could just have the lights. Okay. So now, I'll just have the line talk. So what we're just going to do now is learn how to, about matrices and how to multiply two matrices together. And then what we'll go on to is some quantum mechanics. So how many of you come across the idea of a matrix before? Okay, so much people. So just, I kind of like the idea of a grid that we might have, I guess, in simple case, a 2x2 grid, and we just sort of have a number here, and a number there, and a number there. So it's just a way of kind of compactly representing numbers in a 2x2 grid. So a 2x2 matrix might be just 1, 2, 1, 2. And so obviously we've got a number of rows here, one row, two row, and number of columns, one column, and two columns. And we call that a 2x2 matrix. It has two rows and two columns. So two being the number of rows, and two the number of columns. So just if we can multiply two numbers together, we can multiply two matrices together. So we will. So I guess put the multiplication sign in. So write down two matrices and the question is, what does that equal? What rule do we use to multiply these two matrices together? And what we do is, turns out that if find what this likes to produce is a 2x2 matrix. And and it's 2x2 because the 2 comes from the fact that we're just counting the number of rows we have here, which is 1 and 2, and then the number of columns we have here, which is 1 and 2 going down like that. And so in general, I guess, we just need to find out, and I should say sometimes, only sometimes, we multiply two matrices together. But in this case, you can, and the result is a matrix that has, I guess, we get two rows and two columns. So what we do is find the element in the first row and the first column. What we do is, I guess, go along to the first row and down the second one, down the first column in the second matrix, and multiply these two terms together in these two. So corresponding terms in the first row, the first matrix, and the first column in the second matrix. So we have 2 multiplied by 1 there, plus 4 multiplied by 1 here. And then to find out the term in the first row, second column, we look at the first row in the first matrix, second column in the second matrix, and multiply these two terms together, 2x2, and then 4x3, and that gives us, 16. And here, you get the second row, first column, it's 3x1, and then 1x1, which gives us 4, and then the last one, second row, second column, gives us 9 here. So we end up with 6 in that case. So that's probably all we'll actually be looking at, multiplying 2x2 matrices together. But in the general case, we can have one matrix here, and that could have, I guess, A1 rows, and B1 columns. And like we have another matrix here we're trying to multiply it by, and that could have A2 rows. So A2 is a number there, and then B2 columns. B2 is a number there, and so sometimes you can multiply two matrices together and sometimes you can't. And in general, what you have to have is the number of columns in the first has equal the number of rows in the second. So what we want is these two to equal each other. And so these would be 2, would be 3, or just the same number. And if we can, if they are, then we can multiply two matrices together. If not, then you can't. So I guess we had a matrix, I guess, 2, 1, 1 like this, so 2 columns, and we just had a matrix, it was 3, 1, 3 like this, and we thought, well, let's try and multiply these together, turns out number of columns, there are two columns here, number of rows, and so two obviously is not equal to one, so it just doesn't work. You can't multiply two matrices together like that. So what we'll mainly be doing is just multiplying two by two matrices together. So I'll just do one example, get you to do that. So again, a very simple one. Okay, sure. Just pay attention for a minute. Okay, so I guess, say for example, 2x2 matrix. What you want to do is going to write a term. I might just put labels on them here, just to denote which rows and columns they're in. And find out the term in this term. What we do is we look at, that's in the first row and the first column, and so what we do is just look at the first row, the first matrix, and it's in the first column, so we look at the first column, in the second matrix, and we just look at the first term in each of those, and multiply those two together. So that's A11 multiplied by B11, and then look at the second term in each of those rows or columns, or row or column, and multiply those two together to get that one. And in general, if we want to find the term in, I guess, the nth row and an nth column, we just look at the nth row here and the nth column, and then just look at corresponding with the first terms in each of those, multiply those together. Okay, so what we'll get you to do is do one example now. So probably as far as we'll go is, it doesn't have to just be restricted to 2x2, we can have 3x3 matrices to multiply together, or even they don't even have to have the same both numbers of rows and columns. So just to give you a feel, maybe if you could, multiply that, and so maybe I'll see you 4 minutes for that, and we've got an answer. Have a look at your neighbor, check the same answer. Yeah. Okay, there's a lot of talking going on, so sounds like everyone's done. So what we do to modify through these two matrices out, then so we want to find this term. This term first in the first row and the first column, so we just go across, find the first row in the first matrix, and highlight the first column in the second one, and take the first terms in each of those, multiply those together, 1 by 2 is 2, and 2 by 4 is 8, and then we just add those together to give us 10 in that case. Yep, exactly. So first row, second column, 1 by 1 is 1.
That's something we're getting confused about because you didn't explain it over there.
Oh.
You just did the first row, first column, second row, second column.
Oh, sorry. Okay, thank you for pointing that out. Yeah. Okay, so what I should have said was I can show it by this example, but if you want to find this term, so that's first row, second column. Again, just as for the first row, first column, we'll look at the first row here, the first column there. Well, to find out the first row and second column, what we do is look at the first row in this one and the second column in this one. And if these were 3 by 3 matrices and we wanted to find out the element in the third row and the third column of multiplying them together, what we would do is look at the third row in the first matrix and the third row in the third column in the second, and they were n by n matrices, and we want to find out the n, the term in the resultant matrix in the nth row and nth column, then we look at the nth row and nth column, what nth row in the first matrix.
There is a trick to show if you can multiply them together and what you should end up with. Like if you had a 2 by 2 matrix, you actually write 2 by 2 and 2 by 2, and if the last number in the first set, you would need.
You mentioned to know whether you can multiply them up.
Yeah, you can multiply them up, but then it'll show what the n matrices should be.
Oh, you mean the dimensions of them?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So I'll just finish this example, but yeah, that's absolutely. So again, the first row, second column, what we found was 1 by 1, and the second piece is 3. And this example is the second row, first column, and we have 1 by 2 and 3 by 12, so this gives us 14. And then second row, second column, which is 1 by 1, so it's just 4, and 3 by 1, so that's the answer for that example. In this case, it kind of turns out to be fairly simple. This will just be one element. You'll see a number, and look at the first row, first column, 1 by 2, and 4 by 7, so that gives us 30 in that case. And I guess we can know, the trick must be you were saying that you just look at the dimensions of this resultant line, must be just the number of rows in the first multiple and the columns in the second.
So does
everyone, yes? Sorry?
Yeah.
Oh, I hear what you mean. Yeah, you're right. Yep, I see it. Thank you for that.
With that. This is like one matrix, and the other matrix, these terms are the same, multicolor, and your end result is U2 by 2 matrix.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Maybe we could talk about that like in the afternoon. But yeah, that's a good point.
This is
just yeah. Okay. So does everyone want to go through more examples or?
I
go
1 by 2.
Yes.
I'll do 4 by 2 because these are the same.
So 4
by
1. So 4 by 4?
Something
a bit more involved. Okay. Well, this is probably all you'll be dealing with, but we'll just do it here. We'll just do one more example. Then. Okay, so we want a bigger matrix. Okay. Probably a bit too big. So this will be a 4x4 matrix. This will be a 4x4 matrix, and we have 4 rows here and 4 columns in the second one. So has anyone got the first
element.
So is that large enough for now?
Yeah.
Okay. So should we start with one of your hands? Okay. Turn the lights down. So okay, we'll start. I think you've got to do the notes. And so what we're going to look at now is quantum mechanics, and arguably this is the most accurate and the most successful theory in the history of physics. And just roughly speaking, it describes a whole range of things. Primarily, quantum physics is the physics of the small, although not exclusive. It's the physics of atoms and molecules, and how they move around in motion, and how they interact with each other. And so, okay, so what is quantum mechanics? And so what we'll do is have a look at some of the basic principles, a little bit of the math behind it. And we'll go on to something called quantum information. And that's really technologies, new 21st century technologies placed. On quantum physics. And what we'll probably end up with and have a look at near the end of the week is something called entanglement. And that really is the essence of quantum mechanics. And we'll probably touch on something called Bell's theorem, which has been called the most profound discovery in all of science, in the history of science. And this really is the heart of quantum mechanics, the physical principle related to Bell's theorem and entanglement. So we'll end up looking at that. What?
Spell.
Okay, so what actually is quantum mechanics? So I need to check that out. Actually, this was slides for teaching workshops. So just ignore that. So I think to most people, quantum mechanics is incredibly, incredibly puzzling and strange. And even the people that made it, even the people that discovered it and invented it, found it very strange. And Niels Bohr said, and he actually won a Nobel Prize and was there in the early days. He was a crucial contributor to quantum mechanics and what it meant. He said, if you do not get dizzy sometimes when you think about these things within quantum physics, then you have not really understood it. So if any of you kind of start to feel dizzy at any stage while we're learning this in a couple of days, then that's potentially a sign that you're understanding this. Even Richard Feynman, great US physicist, who won a Nobel Prize for his contribution to quantum mechanics or quantum physics. I guess I should say I'll probably just kind of use the terms quantum mechanics and quantum physics interchangeably. I'll probably try and stick with quantum mechanics, but I'll probably change around a bit. But I mean the same by those two terms. And he said, in the 60s, I think it was, I think I can safely say that nobody understands quantum mechanics. So at some level, even if the people that made it, the people that discovered it, these geniuses, if they're saying this, what hope do we have? Well. And I think one reaction that people have to quantum mechanics is that, you know, am I missing something about it? They kind of, when you hear about things like the double slit experiment or entanglement or some very, very strange properties in quantum physics, people think that have trouble getting it and understanding it at an intuitive level. And they say, well, is there something that I'm missing? You know, there's some sort of trick or way of looking at things. Because I think that most people like thinking in pictures. And images, and people say, just give me a picture of what's going on. It's just very, very tough to come up with a picture of what's going on in quantum physics. And people have, but just the pictures are very, very weird. And we'll look at those probably on Friday. And just as maybe some consolation, a scientist recently said, if you find the theory difficult to understand, then this is the fault of the theories, not yours. So I don't know if that would really sort of be a good excuse if you failed the quantum mechanics exam to present that for your teacher, but just the idea is that, well, I guess that in some ways, well, it'll make more sense on the next slide. And so in some ways, quantum physics is primarily just a mathematical framework. So it's kind of these sort of math equations and math and principles to kind of turn the handle or just
produce some result, and that result corresponds to what you see in experiment. And typically, it corresponds to some probability you observe in experiment. I guess in the world, using everything's cert, so you're either going to find a particle here, a baseball here, or a tennis ball here, or there. But in quantum mechanics, it's all probabilities. So you might have a 50% chance of finding or measuring an electron here, and a 50% chance there. So kind of the certainty is taken away. And so quantum mechanics just provides this mathematical framework, this machinery or apparatus to, again, turn the handle and just look through the equations and come up with what you might find out in an experiment. So one very simple schematic experiment, you might have just a very, very hot filament. So it's a very, very hot piece of metal, we would heat to thousands of degrees, and eventually it will emit, just spit off lots of electrons. In a sense, they'll get boiled off. And we might have some kind of laboratory here, and something that measures the electron, and we might have some chance, some probability that we'll measure the electron at that detector. And quantum mechanics provides a way to calculate that probability for finding the electron at various locations. And what we use, again, we see something called the wave function, which won't go into too much details, but in a sense, that we can think of that as like a probability wave, or maybe more correctly, a probability amplitude wave. So it seems to be, seems to have properties like a wave, kind of a water wave spread out in space, but doesn't quite seem to be something that's sort of real, it's really existing out there. Or just kind of sums up what we know, our probabilities for knowing, well, the electron's probably here, or maybe it's there. And what quantum mechanics does not provide in itself is an account or a picture of what's going on. So really, it tells us all the probabilities that we'll find when we measure the electron here. But what we'd probably like to know as scientists, we really want to know about reality, what does the electron do when it leaves, I guess, the filament here and goes, moves towards the detector? How's it behaving? Does it go in a straight line? Does it have a break in the middle? Does it go in loops? Well, quantum mechanics doesn't really tell us the answer to that. So, and in short, we don't really know. We have a number of ideas and theories, and these are interpretations of quantum mechanics, but there's no agreed upon answer. So this is still, in between here is a mystery here, is extremely, extremely well understood, because in some sense, quantum mechanics, I said, it's one of the most accurate and most successful theories in nature, and that's because since the 1920s, it'd be 1920s when it was discovered, no accepted experiment has disagreed with it. So scientists in many, many countries have been performing experiment after experiment after experiment, and all of them have agreed with quantum mechanics. And moreover, it can predict, as I mentioned before, some properties, such as the magnetic moment of the electron, down to one part in 10 billion. And so I think I mentioned this before, but to give you a sense of scope, if you could know the distance or predict the distance from here to Toronto with the same accuracy, we would not have been within 1/100th of a millimeter. So I have some predictions are phenomenally, phenomenally accurate. Okay. So just an analogy there, in some sense, quantum mechanics is a bit like an instruction manual for a DVD player. So if we have buy a brand new DVD player, or our parents do, then we look at open up the manual, and what it does, it tells us which buttons to press, play, stop, pause, whenever, record on our DVD manual. But it doesn't explain the underlying electronics, how the DVD player works, the integrated circuits, the transistors, the capacitors, and so forth. So it doesn't, you know, the manual doesn't explain, you know, how the DVD player works at a fundamental level. But it explains it enough so you can use the DVD player. You can play, you know, really cool movies, Star Wars, and so forth. Well, I saw the episode of Dallas 3, I thought it was good. Okay. So quantum mechanics, in a sense, it only tells us what buttons to press, and i.e. what kind of math calculation to do to determine the probability of finding an electron or an atom or whatever we're dealing with. So it's silent as to what's really going on in the world out there, so to speak. And that might seem kind of strange. You might think, well, you know, isn't physics all about discovering, you know, the laws of the universe or the way the universe works? And certainly this did trouble a lot of people. It troubled Einstein deeply. He never really reconciled himself to quantum mechanics ever at all in his life. And you read about some of that in the book. So we'll just switch over here. And, yep, great, and come up. So, fantastic. So what we'll do is just go to the next page. And what we'll going to actually look at. This is a way that a lot of people use to explain and introduce quantum mechanics. And that is something called the double slit. Experiment. How many of you have heard or know about the double slit experiment? Okay, great. So a few people. So most people. But we'll actually go into a reasonable amount of depth because it's surprisingly a simple experiment. You can explain it to the people in 10, 15 minutes. But yet it has almost all of the stuff there. It has a lot of deep, deep results. And still, at some level, it's not fundamentally understood. So let's just you know, clear, kind of press the wipe on our brains and sort of clear our heads of quantum mechanics for a minute. And just let's think about what a wave. Let's just start from there. So what you can actually do, you get interference patterns with water waves. You could have this could be a lake or a pond or even the reflecting pond out there. You get two stones and you drop them in, I guess, those two points there and there. And what happens, you get ripples. So the ripples kind of spread out, as you can see there. And if we have some kind of wall or just, a row of corks lined up here, what we can see is how the waves, sort of the two ripples that are spreading and how they interfere or with each other or how they combine with each other. And so what we would find is we'd find a point right in the middle there, halfway between where we dropped two stones in, and we would find we'd get the waves coming from, or the ripples coming from both these two points, they'd be in sync with each other, they'd be in phase with each other. So what we would find out, we would get constructive interference here. And so that would mean we just get a crest appearing with a crest, and trough coming with the trough. And so they always kind of combine. And so if we had a little cork there in the water, that would bob up and down quite a fair bit. So there'd be lots of jostling and bobbing up and down. There'd be a lot of energy there. But if we sort of went a little bit further away, we would find the waves would be slightly out of sync. They'd be slightly out of phase. It wouldn't totally, completely, constructively interfere with each other. And we'd find a cork would kind of bob up and down, but not quite as much. As we go a little bit further and further along, we would find the cork would bob up and down even less. Until we get to this point here, and what we would find is actually this is where we have destructive interference. So physically, we find a point, and it would be a cork, and it would be pretty much, it would be stationary. It would be not moving at all. And the way we explain that would be that we would have the water or the ripple coming from here and coming from there, and it's just the ripples are they're out of phase with each other by pi. So they're out of, we have destructive interference. And so what that means is that we have a crest coming with the trough, and so we have a sort of high energy wave, well, a high amplitude and a low and a negative amplitude, and then they cancel each other out. And so that happens all times, and so what we have is we actually end up with a, so if you sort of add to the plus 5 and then minus, take away 5 from that, you get 0. So we have the net amplitude, or resultant amplitude there for the wave is 0, and that's happens at all for all time. And so if we again just look at the row of cork, we kind of get a sort of one that's popping up and down a lot still. And then what we do find is we again get constructive interference again. So we get this pattern of sinusoid. So it's basically kind of waving itself. And we get sort of cork popping up and down a lot, and then in between, not moving, and then a lot, and then not moving, and so forth. And so it might do is then we actually look at a, when I look at a measure of, I guess, something that's proportional to the intensity or the energy of how much of the cork, well, I guess, and the energy of the cork bobbing up and down. What we might do is represent that by, or something proportional to that by psi squared. So we might introduce this Greek letter psi here, and the square of that, we might say that's a measure of the energy of each of these little quarks we have, or whatever we have, energy detectors here, dropping up and down. So again, we've introduced this idea of psi squared here. And so, I guess, that the energy of a wave is proportional to its the square of its amplitude. So the wave intensity in certain units is the square of the wave amplitude, and that will give us our psi squared. So psi, in this sense, is like the amplitude, is what the amplitude of the wave, or the height of the cork bobbles. So going to the next page. So again, so what we'll find is that classical concepts, wave and particle, is very, very useful in explaining bits of quantum mechanics,
but there's still some weirdness. It's very, very hard to explain. All of quantum mechanics in terms of just one consistent part. Oops. So imagine we just wanted to make single water waves, so we don't have two sources, we just have one source. How can we actually be clever and get interference? Before we had two sources, to actually get them to interfere with each other, well, we can really be a little bit tricky, and what we can do is actually just get one stone, drop it in here, ripple spread out, and we get something like a wall or some barrier, and we just put two little holes or two little slits. And this is where the name the double slit experiment comes from. These are two holes or slits. What we can do is, if they're small enough, then what we do is, I guess you've seen this, the waves kind of come out in sort of curved or potentially spherical or circular patterns here if the slits here are quite narrow. And this is just diffraction. So this is Huygens' principle. These waves, as you know, the fractals spread out after they go through a barrier. So this is what's happening up here, and it's happening there. So even though we had one source, we can convert that into two sources. And basically, if we just forget about what's happening there, then this pattern of these two waves spreading out, or ripples spreading out, combining with each other, that's exactly the same as we saw on the previous page. We just have a different source or a different way of producing the waves. And so as we have exactly the same two wave patterns spreading out, interfering with each other, if we again had a row of corks here in this pond, or we actually said some other way of measuring the intensity or the amplitudes of, well, I guess, the intensity or energy here, hitting this wall or detector, what we would find exactly the same pattern, because we had exactly the same two types of waves combining with each other. So again, we get constructive and destructive interference alternating. And so this just represents that typically what we have is we have diffraction here. So this is just, I guess, a hypothetical example of what would happen if we didn't have diffraction, or so that would be our case. Maybe if the wavelength was very, very small, we could get just a small amount of diffraction, and so we just end up, the wavefronts would go in a straight line like that. But typically, in realistic experiments, this is what we see. So again, just dealing with water waves. So that's really just to get introduced to the idea of waves, classical waves. Now let's look at what happened with electrons. So, and what we're leading into and thinking about is, what actually are electrons? What are atoms? Can we think of electrons and atoms as just like scaled down tiny, tiny, tiny miniature tennis balls or grains of sand? Or are they different? And so we'll see that, well, they're different, but in some of a slightly complicated, slightly strange kind of way. And so what we have, and this is, I'd like to describe an experiment that has been done. So, and this is basically just taking, replacing the water waves, the ripples, with an electron gun. So we take away, we still have the two slits and the final wall here, the final set of detectors. And what we have is an electron gun. And so that, essentially, we can think of that as being a just some kind of very, very hot piece of metal, heat it up to about 1,000 degrees, and then you can spit electrons out of that. And what we do is we spit electrons out of that, and what we do, we don't set it up so that they go out in any consistent way or any particular way. They just end up in some kind of higgledy-piggledy fashion like this, or some relatively random fashion. And what we do know is roughly they have the same kind of momentum or magnitude of momentum, but some of them come up here, some of them come up there, some come up there, and so forth. So what happens if we have a fairly hot electron gun, then what happens is the electrons actually go fairly quickly, and so we see very little, very, very little diffraction in that case. So what we find out is roughly half of them will go up here, so we find a little clump, or if we actually want to measure where the electrons are, we have just some detectors or electron catchers here, trying to find out how many go up here, how many go up there. Well, again, we're kind of randomly spraying them out here. This is typically what happens in the experiment. And so as you might expect, half of them will go through there, half through there. What we find is very hot electrons, you see very little diffraction, and you get a whole bunch of kind of a clump there, and a whole bunch of them coming there. And they don't come at exactly the same point, so there's a little sort of bell-shaped curve and a bell-shaped curve there. And I guess what we can equate the, the probability distribution we find here with
I guess we find here, we can equate that with psi squared, we possibly should have a magnitude of psi squared there, but that's not too important at the moment. But again, essentially what we find here is this is some, what we can do is if we get some kind of measure, some kind of measure of the probability of what we find the electrons here, and that relates to this function psi, or you can actually, I guess, describe it by psi, by the square of some other function psi, and psi is related to the amplitudes. Well, I guess the amplitudes are the wave functions of the electrons there, which probably should have amplitudes signs there. But I just really want to get across this idea that, again, just the probability pattern that we actually see. And the fact that we can relate psi squared to that pattern. So what if we actually change the experiment a bit? We actually had somehow got cooler and cooler, so colder, slower moving electrons coming out of this electron gun. It turns out what we actually see is what we're doing is we're changing two things. So we actually make the electrons coming out colder and slower, and we actually expose a point of slit. So let's just make it simple, just where the electrons can only go through there. What we do find is that basically this kind of little hump that we had gets spread out a lot further. And so what that suggests is, as it says, diffraction, exclamation mark, it suggests diffraction, because if we had just classical tennis balls or shooting out of a tennis ball machine coming out of particles, what we would find, we'd expect them all to come there, and we wouldn't find any here. And so, but what if we had waves then coming through there? Again, if we had just a source of water waves coming out, we would find they would spread out, and we find, I guess, patterns similar to this here. So it's exactly the same sort of pattern we would expect with waves, and so this is why this suggests diffraction. If we didn't, and these electrons could be thought of as reacting just as tiny, tiny scaled down particles, beer balls, or tennis balls, and what we would find is we just find a little tall, tiny clump there that we don't. So this, certainly when people first found something like this experimentally, it seemed very strange, because I think most people have in their mind of an atom as being, again, like a tiny scale down tennis ball or a baseball, and I think certainly a lot of the physicists in the 1920s did. And so in experiments like this, or that showed similar effects, that was very, very strange. And it seems to be, what this is saying is that electrons can act in a sense like water waves. There seems to be a bit of waviness to electrons. And that's a very, very deep result in quantum physics. Okay, so. Oops. So let's repeat the experiment, but let's close the top slit and open the bottom one and see what happens. Well, what we do see is we see the same spread out diffraction like pattern, but of course it's kind of shifted down a bit because we get the big hump or the central peak here kind of in line with where an electron would be if it went straight through this line here. And we had the hump there in line with where an electron would be if it went straight through there. Okay. So let's actually do something a little quantitative. Let's actually count electrons. And imagine if we had the top slit open, the bottom slit closed, then if we just pick some kind of region here, some narrow region or interval, we'll actually calculate how many electrons we have here, every thousand we got through. So we're often in quantum mechanics, you do things and you repeat the experiment. And you build up statistics. So it's again probability. So it's exactly like if you were trying to count the probability of getting heads on tossing a coin or rolling or getting a certain number for rolling a die, you would toss the coin 100 times and see whether you get 50-50 heads, tails, or maybe perhaps the coin is rigged and you get 95% of heads, 5% tails. But to find that experimentally, you'd have to do the experiment over and over again. This is why we talk about 1,000 electrons coming through here. Hypothetically, we could find an experiment in this region here that 60 electrons might hit when we have the bottom slit closed, and that would be 6%, so 6% of the electrons coming through here. And moving to the other next experiment, the closed top slit, open the bottom one, And we could look at the same, exactly the same kind of region, so exactly the same region here. What we'll find is maybe a few less electrons, because this region now is exactly, well, it's a little bit further away from the central pump of the central peak. So maybe we get actually 40 out of every 1,000 electrons going through. So this is sort of a rough example, but people have done, I mean, I think it was about the 70s or 80s, people actually did essentially this experiment that I'm talking about now. So this is something that's very well understood experimentally and very well understood even theoretically by quantum mechanics, even a long way before then. And people kind of knew what the experiment was going to be, but relied on quantum mechanics, quantum physics, and that had been extremely well verified. And so what we might do is open both slits and see what happens at this particular point, the same point. So what we did, just to recap, we had one bottom slit closed and find the electrons going through. And then we opened the bottom slit and closed the top one. And 40 came through, and 60 in the first case. So I think a very natural thing we think is if we actually have combined both experiments, so we're going to have 2,000 electrons going through, 1,000 from each of the top experiments, and well, maybe we're going to sort of overlay the two experiments on each other. And so we should get 60 plus 40 equals 100. So 100 electrons coming through and hitting the screen or being detected here in this region, exactly this region here, in this experiment where we have both slits open. That kind of seems, does that seem intuitive to people? Okay, great. So, I mean, if we did this with tennis balls or baseballs and people were throwing baseballs here, that's exactly what would happen. You just add the number of electrons from, baseballs or tennis balls from both experiments, and that's what you get. And certainly, and here's the magic of quantum mechanics, that if we actually pick that point, that region right, what we can actually find is we can get zero electrons coming through. So, and this is a very, very weird result. So just to recap, what we had is we had one slit open, and we got 60 electrons going through. We had another slit open, we got 40 electrons through. And now let's open both slits. The electrons have twice as many ways of getting through to the other side. And so when we just, at the very worst, when we just had one slit open, we had 40 electrons through. And then we open up another slit, and we give the electrons another way to get through. So we should get more electrons going through. You know, we're giving them more opportunities to get to the other side and to be detected at this particular point. But somehow, what we actually find, and again, this has been experimentally verified, people have done experiments on this, you can actually find, for some regions, you can get no electrons coming through. And so this is a bit weird. Certainly, it's very hard to explain if you think of electrons as being like tiny scaled-down tennis balls. And so what is happening is, but the interesting thing is, this is kind of similar to what we get with waves, with wave pattern. And so the pattern we actually get, what I should have said, is the pattern of electrons are hitting the screen, or the probability pattern is kind of a wavy pattern like this. So it's sinusoidal, and it might look familiar, so we get a lot of electrons hitting here. What I should say is when we have a large hump here, this means a lot of electrons being measured or detected or hitting there, and then very few, and then a lot. So I guess the direction here is just a measure of the probability, so along this axis here. And so this might look familiar. So it's exactly the classical interference pattern we get with water wells. So what that suggests is that electrons, again, have a bit of a waviness to them, have a bit of a wave-like nature. Okay. And one way of looking at it is, in a sense, you can actually even do this where, because I've done experiments where you only get one electron going through at any time. So like one electron through, wait for it to hit the detection screen, wait a while, let another electron go through, wait a while, let another one go through. And over time, after many, many electrons, you've got up exactly the same pattern. So one natural way of thinking about it seems as if each electron is somehow interfering with itself. So we only ever have one going through. You can set the experiment up and they've done this at any one time. And it seems that somehow an electron can interfere with itself, just in the same way that a water wave, a spread out water wave, can. So this is some kind of strength. Okay, so
with
and so what we do find, if we have something, a particle, if the electron has a wave, like nature, then, well, maybe it has a wavelength. And so what is that wavelength? Well, it turns out that if we actually, you can actually calculate what, I guess classically, you can, classically again, if we go back to the experiment with classical water waves, what you can actually calculate from how far it is between the central maximum here to this first minimum, you can actually, basically just using some simple trigonometry and geometry, you can actually relate that back to what the wavelength, to what the wavelength is of the water wave that you have. And just qualitatively, because the smaller the wavelength of the water wave, then the more bunched up this pattern is, this interference pattern, and the larger the wavelength of the water wave is, the spread out. So that's a qualitative relationship between the spread out, how sort of stretched out like in a the pattern is the interference pattern, so you can get more, you actually get a quantitative relationship. So if you know, just measure this distance here, you can actually figure out and measure what the wavelength of a water wave is. And so by analogy, what we can do is we could do an experiment where we could have electrons of a whole range, various momentums or momenta, going through these two slits here, and we could actually, so we get an experiment, so I have just a whole range of momenta, so 5, 10, 15 kilograms meters per second. Or I guess probably that'd be a lot smaller than that. And we could, for each of those different momenta, we could actually write down and find out how far this central minimum, this first minimum is from the central maximum. And from that, what we could do is we could get and actually measure and calculate what the wavelength is. So calculate what the wavelength is. And so we could get kind of two tables up where we have momentum on one wing column and the wavelength for the electron or wavelength we would have for a corresponding wave in the next column. And we could maybe look for some kind of relation between them. Is there any relation between the momentum of the electron that goes through and what its wavelength seems to be, what the wavelength would be for a corresponding water wave? And what we can actually find is there actually is a relation. And what the relationship is, if we multiply the two together, we always come up with one particular number. So you multiply the wavelength, all the momenta, by the wavelengths, and you end up with this one number. And what it turns out to be is 6.63 by 10 to the minus 34 joule seconds. And that actual number is Planck's constant. And that's something, because Max Planck was the person that first, I guess, discovered or first used it. And that turns up, that's everywhere in quantum mechanics. And really, in some sense, it defines the quantum scale. And so 10 to the minus 34 joule seconds is incredibly tiny. And so what that leads you to think is quantum mechanics, again, I'm primarily concerned about incredibly, incredibly tiny particles. So, what we'll just finish up with, this is kind of a nice spot to finish up with. And so they have, the game has done a lot of experiments, and you can find out from this, and a rather great experiment, again, that's just the Planck's constant there. And as I said before, we can relate the momentum of the electron being spat out by the electron gun, or really, I guess that's the magnitude of momentum there, to the wavelength that it seems to have. So the waviness that it seems to have, we can actually measure by finding out, looking at the properties of the interference pattern. And I guess the interference pattern we've seen in how spread it out is, or squashed in is, that's like the signature of the wavelength. So it tells us what the wavelength is. And so we can actually find out what the product of those two is. And it turns out we get this nice little lead equation here, and this is that lambda multiplied by p equals h. And so this is a very, very crucial, central, important equation in quantum physics or quantum mechanics, and it's a very, very deep result. And what seems to be happening, we saw definitely electrons do have a particle-like nature. Sometimes act like tiny scale down tennis balls or baseballs, and we saw that in the case where we had very, very hot electrons, and we just soaked them through the two slits, and then swing through as tiny baseballs or tennis balls would. We just end up two clumps and no diffraction. But also we found out electrons have a wavy-like nature. You can actually get an individual electron interfering with each other. So they seem to have this dual nature, or this twin nature, a bit sort of schizophrenic, if you like. And so they have this sort of part wave-like nature, that's represented by the wavelength lambda, and also a particle-like nature that's represented by momentum. So normally we associate momentum with a particle. Momentum classically equals mv, the mass of the particle multiplied by its velocity. And so what this equation does is kind of a synthesis, or, well, it's really a combination, and so, or an amalgamation of the wave and particle-like aspects, which is the two halves of quantum physics. In a sense, sort of the yin and the yang, and we that's actually the multiplied together to give H, and that actually sets the scale for quantum mechanics. And so this is a very deep equation, and it has conceptually, looking at it at a conceptual level, it has the quantum element, and on the other side, both the two main features that Niels Bohr thought were crucial, the wave-like aspect or feature. And so in a sense, quantum theory, you can think of that as a consistent unification of the wave and particle aspects. And it's very difficult to think of the electron as just being a wave and always acting like a wave, and it's very difficult to think of it acting like a particle. So what an electron is, so when people say, you know, is an electron a wave or a particle? I mean, in a sense, it's neither. A wave is something that always 100% of the time acts like a wave. Particle is something that always 100% of the time acts like a particle. And so some people have said the electrons are wavelets. So I'd just like to, I think I'll end on that. The new word, new vocabulary. So it's lunchtime.
Eric. Yeah, I've got a lot of things.